All right. Try something a little different this morning. It seems silly to print off everything if the computer already has it, so this could work really well or it could work really bad. It's part of the Paper Reduction Act that the trustees passed last year that goes into effect in 2016, so we're getting ready for it. All right, well, let's take our Bibles and turn to Psalm 7. And follow along, and I'll look for a volunteer to read, preferably in the ESV. Damon read last week, so let's look for a new, fresh volunteer. We'll, in this church, we even let women read Scripture, so women can volunteer if you want. You didn't like that comment, Denny.
There's a lot of us didn't like
it. It was meant to be sort of, you know, an embracing comment, not the other way around. Thank you, Karen. You're a good reader. Would you stand so your voice will carry?
The entire psalm.
Yeah, the entire psalm, all 17 verses.
Psalm 7. O Lord, my God, take refuge in you. Save and deliver me from all who pursue me, for they will tear me like a lion and rip me to pieces with no one to rescue me. O Lord, my God, if I have done this and there is guilt on my hands, if I have done evil to him, or without cause have robbed my foes, then let my enemy pursue and overtake me. Let him trample my life to the ground and make me sleep in the dust. Arise, O Lord, in your anger. Rise up against the rage of my enemies. Await, my God, decree justice. Let the assembled people gather around you. Rule over them from on high. Let the Lord judge judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness, according to my integrity, O Most High, O righteous God, who searches minds and hearts. Bring to an end the violence of the wicked and make the righteous secure. My shield is God Most High, who saves the upright in heart. God is a righteous judge, God who expresses his wrath every day. If he does not relent, he will sharpen his sword. He will bend and string his bow. He has prepared his deadly weapons. He makes ready his flaming arrows. He who is pregnant with evil and conceives trouble gives birth to disillusion. He who digs a hole and scoops it up falls into the pit he has made. The trouble he causes recoils on himself. Violence comes down on his own head. I will give thanks to the Lord because of his righteousness.
All right, thank you, Karen. All right, well, this psalm is a bit easier than the one that we looked at last week. It is similar in the sense that it starts off with David expressing anguish over a particular problem and concludes on a high note of assurance. As you will remember, Psalm 6 was a little bit of a challenge to harmonize everything from beginning to end. We don't really have too much of that problem here in Psalm 7. And because there isn't anything here all that difficult to explain, we should be able to move through it fairly quickly. The last two sermons here, Dave's 2 weeks ago and mine last week, were a little bit on the long side. And so today we'll be able to make up for it for something a little shorter. Dave went 15 minutes over. I went like maybe three or four. And so we need to get those minutes back somehow, sometime, and we'll be able to do a little bit of that today. All right. So what?
It's all about the minutes.
It's all about the minutes.
19 minutes.
We owe it. All right. So did everyone get their homework? You all look very enthused this week. Last week you were more enthused about it. How many worked on it? How many completed it? All right, very good. Not quite the same proportion we had the week before. How many felt good about what you worked on? Okay, good. All right, want another one for this week? Okay. How many think this is burdensome and you feel obligated to do it and you don't want to do it and you'd rather not be bothered? Okay. All right, well, suggested titles for this psalm. In you do I take refuge. The righteous, God loves the righteous. A cry for justice. And a prayer to overthrow the oppressors. All right, so part of your assignment was, what title would you have come up with? Anyone have something that you'd like to contribute at this point? As you read the psalm and thought you might assign your own title to it, what would you come up with? Anyone? What's that? Speak it up.
I said plead for justice pretty close.
Okay, all right. Something that's a little different than what you see there. Anybody? Tom.
I found that Spurgeon titled it the Song of the Slandered Saint.
Okay. All right. That's a good title. All right. Well, let's start with the heading. Two things worth noting there in that superscript, those annotations. We are introduced to yet another new word that we really don't know anything about, and that word is a Shigeion. And this is the only occurrence of the word in the whole Psalter. It's probably a musical term, or it could identify the type of psalm that it is. The heading claims that this psalm was written in response to a particular situation, something that Cush the Benjaminite had said. Did anyone find that story anywhere? Did anyone look for the story? Okay, well, if you looked, you saw that there's no mention of it in the Bible. So the historical scene behind this psalm will obviously remain a mystery to us. It may be that Cush had been the one who shared with David troubling news that certain enemies were out to get him. And upon that troubling news, David cries out to the Lord for help in the form of this psalm. Or it could be that Cush is actually one of the enemies, or the main enemy, and his words here refer to certain lies that he is spreading about David. Cush then would be the primary object of the psalm, and I think this is a likely scenario. But either way, we can't say for sure. In fact, as pointed out a few weeks ago, these superscripts were added on sometime later. We're not sure when and how all that came to be. There's certain theories about it, but it comes down to all this business here about Cush may not amount to anything anyway, because it's probably based upon some speculation. As we look at an overview of Psalm 7, it begins with an earnest plea for deliverance. David's enemies are depicted as ferocious beasts, eager to attack and tear him apart. He appeals to Yahweh for justice and calls upon him to base his judgment on righteousness alone. Deliver the innocent, punish the wicked. And it concludes with thanksgiving and praise for the deliverance that is expected. Though we are not given details of the situation, it is safe to say that the issue at hand involves opponents of David spreading false accusations about him. His honor is at stake, and so this psalm is, in essence, a response to that slander. All right, so let's now consider the genre or type of psalm that it is, and that would be the first question in your homework. What would you say, which answer did you give to that? Anybody? Psalm 7 is a... Well, it's going to be primarily one. What would be the one that would stand out, do you think? Okay, well, it begins as a lament in verses 1 and 2, and it ends with thanksgiving and praise. So you could, you know, there could be some discussion about that. However, that is actually quite typical of laments. They often start on a high note. Or they often end on a high note. Sometimes that high note would be a statement of confidence and trust, or it might be an expression of joy and gratitude, or it might be, as in this case, an affirming of God's nature and words of worship. Generally speaking, the tone of the psalm is set by the opening statement, the first verse or two. And so we would categorize this psalm as a lament. It starts off with David bringing his complaint or need to the Lord, in this case, the injustice of enemies threatening his life. And that complaint, in fact, does drive the first 16 of its 17 verses. So, all right, so question number 5, which images come to mind? How many checked off a hunt? How many checked off a courtroom? How many a battle? How many did all three? All right. Very good. All right. The correct answer would actually be all three, and we'll see this as we work through it. All three images, though not stated explicitly, are certainly part of the psalm's landscape. And furthermore, they are all intertwined. They're used together and they're used interchangeably. And we actually see those used in other psalms the same way as well. In fact, even in our own culture, in modern times, we often use those very same three images interchangeably to describe some kind of struggle, for instance. take a legal action as an example. He is brought into a court to be settled. It is often experienced as a battle and a hunt. It involves both a fierce confrontation of wills, like a battle, and clever cunning and traps, like a hunt. Soldiers fighting a battle will often talk about ambushing their enemies or hunting them down. And hunting involves one creature seeking to confine or kill another by cunning or force, so it resembles war and judicial procedures and so forth. So any one of the three can be described by the other two, and that's what we see here in this psalm. They are interchangeable, and each one kind of highlights a particular element. And certainly we'll see that in Psalm 7. It begins with David being hunted by his pursuers who are threatening to tear him apart. The image then changes to a courtroom where God is called upon to execute justice on behalf of David, who he claims is the innocent party. And the scene then moves to a battlefield where war is waged with deadly weapons. And the progression of the psalm then moves back into the courtroom and concludes in verse 16 with a hunt, but there the roles are reversed. David incorporates the image of a hunt to call attention to the fact that he is being pursued, sought out, to be attacked. The image of a courtroom illustrates the injustice of it all. There is something morally wrong about this. There is evil involved, and those pursuing him are wicked, something the righteous judge is called upon to settle, to rule on. And the image of the battle emphasizes the fierce determination. A fight for one's honor is involved, perhaps even one's life. There's a lot at stake. This is a just war to wage. David's opponents are referred to in this psalm as pursuers, as the wicked, and as enemies. Did you get that on your homework? As pursuers? How many got those three? Okay. Boy, this is becoming less and less responsive as the morning weighs on. What did you have for that answer? Pursuers, the wicked, and the hunted. Well, let's just look at each one real quick because they dovetail into that. Pursuers would correspond to which image? The hunt, the battlefield, or the courtroom? The hunt, all right? The wicked would correspond to which image? Courtroom, because it's a moral term, you know, and a court, you know, settles disputes regarding moral offenses. And enemies, obviously, would correspond to which image? The enemies corresponds to which image? Battlefield. All right. So again, what appears to be the issue here is slander. Certain opponents of David are seeking to bring him down, perhaps his reign as king. They are successfully rallying people behind them because of the false accusations against David that they have spread among the people. And what the nature of these false accusations are, we cannot say. But the reference to lies in verse 14 and to David's integrity in verse 8, and the proverb at the end about a man's deceit coming back upon him, you know, they all serve as strong clues that slander is the driving issue here. David's very honor, again, is at stake, perhaps his throne, perhaps his life. And this heaviness of what might happen if these lies about him prevail prompts him to call upon God to help, thus Psalm 7. All right, in regards to structure, the psalm could be divided up into these six parts. Verses 1 through 2, we have the appeal to God, and then 3 through 5, an assertion of innocence, and then 6 through 9, God is called upon to judge the matter, to issue a ruling, to adjudicate. 10 through 13, God prepares for judgment, and then we have the fate of the wicked, and 14 through 16, then the last verse, which is a little bit separate because the lament ends at verse 16 and then we conclude with words of praise and worship. So let's spend a little time surveying each of those sections. We'll start with the first one. O Lord my God, in you do I take refuge. Save me from all my pursuers and deliver me, lest like a lion they tear my soul apart, rending it in pieces with none to deliver. All right, the first line, again, sets the tone for the whole psalm. Before David presents his need to the Lord, he confidently expresses his faith in him. You see that in the words, in you do I take refuge. This phrase we actually saw back in Psalm 2, where the righteous who take refuge in God are set in contrast to the wicked who conspire together to rebel against God. And so placing himself in the protective care of Yahweh is the foundation for David's hope of deliverance. That's how the psalm starts off. The image of having his soul torn apart into pieces by a ferocious lion illustrates, of course, both the determination of his enemies and the viciousness of their plans. In section 2, verses 3 through 5, David comes before the Lord in what is essentially a protest. A protest not against God, but against his accusers, against the false charges that they have openly promoted. O Lord, my God, if I have done this, if there is wrong in my hands, if I have repaid my friend with evil or plundered my enemy without cause, let the enemy pursue my soul and overtake it, and let him trample my life to the ground and lay my glory in the dust. All right. This would refer to question 7 on your homework, are a claim to David's innocence. All right, pretty obvious. This claim takes the form of actually an imprecatory prayer against himself, you know, a self-curse, confident that he will be found guiltless of the charges his enemies have accused him of. He puts his neck out and openly accepts any consequences if he were to be found guilty. You know, let my enemy pursue my soul and overtake it. You know, takes us back to that image of a lion in verse 2. It's another way of saying, let them have their way with me. And let him trample my life to the ground and lay my glory in the dust. You know, the second line of that parallelism brings up the image of utter defeat in a battle. Verses 3 through 4 underscore the confidence he has in his innocence. It's sort of like telling the cop who asked to search your car for drugs to, you know, go ahead, you're not going to find anything. If you do, throw me in jail. Have at it. You know, anyone ever been pulled over by a cop here? Anyone ever asked to have your car searched? Really? Okay. All right. So we have a number of people that look like drug dealers in this church or something. I don't know. So, I'm proud to say I've never been asked to have my car searched. But anyway, if an officer... What? They just search it. I think sometimes I have to get permission, unless they smell something. But anyway, so if an officer did want to search your car, you know, obviously you would just say, go ahead, I've got nothing to hide. And making such a statement constitutes, you know, evidence of innocence. So much so that times some people will use that statement as a what? As a bluff. You know, a kind of a tactic in this situation, you know, in this situation for a cop to maybe hesitate and say, oh, well, I'm not going to bother with you. You seem innocent. And you actually see this all the time on the Saturday night reality show, Cops. Anyone watch that show? You see this kind of thing all the time. You know, the suspicious guy gets pulled over for speeding, and then the cop wants to search the car, and the guy says, oh, go ahead, nothing to hide. And then, you know, he kind of decides not to search, and then as he walks away, he smells something or hears something or just gets suspicious, and then they search, and then they find something illegal, and it all makes for great TV. You know, that's how the story goes. But here in Psalm 7, I get into all that to say this. Here in Psalm 7, you know, there is no bluffing. David opens himself up to God Almighty, the one who is able to flawlessly, in his righteousness, test the minds and hearts of everyone, as it says later in this psalm. There is no fooling him. You know, his judgments are just and right. David's claim to innocence is, of course, not a claim to absolute sinlessness, but simply a denial of being the outrageous wrongdoer that his enemies are accusing him of. So essentially, you know, the world can be divided up into the faithful, those who honor God with their lives, and the faithless, those who have no use for him. And David here in the psalm claims to belong to the faithful, that he's innocent in this matter. All right, moving on to the third section. Having asserted his innocence in the matter at hand, David now calls upon God to make a ruling, verses 6 through 9. Arise, O Lord, in your anger, lift yourself up against the fury of my enemies. Awake for me, you have appointed a judgment. Let the assembly of the peoples be gathered about you, over it return on high. The Lord judges the peoples. Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness and according to the integrity that is in me. Oh, let the evil of the wicked come to an end, and may you establish the righteous. You who test the minds and hearts, O righteous God. All right, so David implores the Lord to fulfill his role as the righteous judge, to rise up in burning indignation and call his court to order. Exalted over all, over the assembly of the peoples, the righteous judge is petitioned to hear the case and render a verdict. False charges have been leveled against an innocent person, serious charges, and those responsible must be found guilty and held accountable. And David assumes that God must be angry at what is going on and uses this as motivation for getting him to intervene. One would naturally be terrified to appear in such a court. Even if one were innocent, there is risk involved and the consequences quite severe. But David is willing to take that risk, as stated in the previous section, as long as the case can be submitted to the scrutiny of a righteous judge. And who better than Yahweh, who himself has decreed justice and himself will eventually judge the fate of everyone, as it states in verse 8. Yahweh defines justice, affirms it as righteous, holds humans to its standard, and consistently acts to uphold it. Again, David's confidence rests on two things here: his innocence in the matter and God's ability to be correct in his judgments, just and right. All right, we find in this section a number of action-driven imperatives used by David that we should note here, and some of these are actually more clear in the NIV. Arise, O Lord, lift yourself up against the fury of my enemies. Awake, my God, decree justice. Bring to an end the violence of the wicked. Make the righteous secure. All of which, of course, convey the depth of David's desire to see justice triumph in this matter at hand. If I am guilty, turn me over to my pursuers. Have them do to me what they will. If I am innocent, bring my pursuers to account. And so in verses 8 and 9, he affirms his faith in God's impartiality and God's ability to judge justly, saying basically, nothing is hidden from you. You search the minds and hearts. In the end, the wicked will surely be put in their place, and the righteous will be established and made secure. All right, in the fourth section, verses 10 through 13, God prepares to execute his judgment. My shield is with God, who saves the upright in heart. God is a righteous judge and a God who feels indignation every day. If a man does not repent, God will whet his sword. He has bent and readied his bow. He has prepared for him his deadly weapons, making his arrows fiery shafts. The Most High God weighs the matter and issues forth a verdict, also metes out the consequences of that judgment for both parties, the innocent and the guilty. For the innocent, referred to here as the upright in heart in verse 19, he becomes their shield and defender. The vindication from the judge is itself a protection from the schemes of the wicked. You know, with their accusations proven false, who now will rally behind them? And for those who are found guilty, well, the words in verse 11 say it all. Because God is righteous, abhors evil, he feels indignation constantly, every day. All forms of wickedness and sin, including slander, it all causes him to burn with anger. And furthermore, because God is righteous, evil must be met with the full weight of his disapproval, what we call punishment. All right, now the execution of this indignation here in Psalm 7 is expressed metaphorically, as we see in military terms, somewhat like a mighty soldier waging a war on a battlefield. We have these expressions, the sharpening of the sword, the drawing of the bow. There's this anticipation, the preparing of deadly weapons, the arrows becoming fiery shafts, all of which anticipate defeat, suffering, and utter destruction. Indignation is essentially a combination of action and attitude, a sense of outrage, and the execution of some act of damnation. However, there is, even for the wicked, hope and opportunity for deliverance, as made clear in verse 9. If a man does not repent, indicating, of course, that if he were to repent, he would be spared the penalty of his guilt. When people turn from their wickedness in response to God's indignation, they can heave a huge sigh of relief. Forgiveness is always possible, and God is more than happy to not follow through with his retribution. But if they do not turn, wrath must follow. He will take his deadly arrows, he will draw his bow, and the arrows will become fiery shafts set to bring terror and suffering. But, very important, in this psalm, the wrath of God is not really meant to terrify, but to console. David can take comfort in the fact that God has a resolved and settled opposition to evil. He knows he is innocent of the false accusations of the wicked, and that their lives will be exposed, and that they will be held accountable for their slander against him. This then will make all things right. It will put everything back where it's supposed to be. And he takes comfort in the expected vindication. And that vindication can only come, truly come, from a God who takes such matters like innocence and guilt and righteousness and sin seriously. All right, section 5, verses 14 through 16, the fate of the wicked. Behold, the wicked man conceives evil and is pregnant with mischief and gives birth to lies. He makes a pit, digging it out, and falls into the hole that he has made. His mischief returns upon his own head, and on his own skull his violence descends. All right, in regards to the fate of the wicked, two principles are referred to in this section. The first is in verse 14, what we would call the growth cycle of sin. First, it is conceived. A desire or evil thought occurs to the individual. Instead of rejecting it, he welcomes it, embraces it, owns it. This thought then, like an unborn child in the stages of a pregnancy, develops and grows. What grows is mischief, or as the NIV has it, trouble. And the evil that is conceived takes on a life of its own. There are plots and plans and schemings and unholy ambitions. Agendas are formed. And those plans are then executed. That is, a monster is birthed. Something evil and ugly is produced. Lies. In this case, false accusations and slander against David. There is an agenda to bring him down, and the spreading of lies about him is how this will be pulled off. If the verse sounds familiar, it is because the principle here, and even much of the language, is used in James to describe the growth cycle of desire, sin, and death. The second principle in verses 15 and 16 is one we are all familiar with, commonly known as what goes around comes around. Evil will come home to roost. Here David uses an illustration that all in his day would be quite familiar with. A common way to capture a hunted animal would be to dig a pit for it to fall into. And these pits would be strategically placed. They'd be dug quite deep, like a well or a cistern, and covered with something that would give way once it was stepped on. They would be hidden. And there would be a good deal of, as you can see, planning and cunning involved, scheming. And once an animal is caught in such a homemade booby trap, it would typically be killed by throwing a heavy rock on its head, which is what verse 16 is actually referring to. The principle here, of course, is that the wicked will fall into the very trap they had set for David. Their schemes and lies will now result in their own undoing. You know, so obviously you could think of Haman in the book of Esther. You know, he was hung on the gallows he himself built for Mordecai. The prayer for deliverance, which actually concludes at the end of 16, you know, takes us full circle back to the beginning. In verse 1, David is the one being hunted. Traps are set by his pursuers to catch him so they can kill him, tear him apart, either literally or metaphorically. But here in verse 16, these traps do catch something, but what they catch isn't David. It catches the very hunters who dug those pits. The irony of it conveys this sense of poetic justice that is a fitting end to the psalm. All right, finally, part 6, verse 17, concluding praise and thanksgiving. I will give to the Lord the thanks due to his righteousness, and I will sing praise to the name of the Lord, the Most High. David ends the psalm by reaffirming the theme of God's righteousness. Yahweh is to be praised because in his judgments he can be counted on to do what is right. We can count on him to uphold the godly and punish evildoers. Verse 17 is a parallelism. You probably saw that. The first phrase emphasizes God's righteousness. The second, God's power, as in the use of the title Most High. David's hope, as expressed in the psalm, lies in the combination of both. Because of his righteousness, it is God's will to execute justice. And because he is the Most High, he is able to execute it. Thus, assured of both, David is able to not only feel a great sense of confidence and relief, but to also express gratitude to the Lord, and more than that, even sing praises to the name of the Lord. All right, so back to your homework here to kind of finalize a few things. Let's have some more interaction. What emotions do you see expressed in this psalm by David? Fire away. What emotions do you see? Fear? Certainly. Yep. Chris? Despair? Okay.
Anger?
Okay. Yep.
Gratitude?
Good.
Confidence?
I would add hope to that. Yep. What else?
Good.
Frustration? I don't know if you call trust an emotion, but there's that. It's very similar to confidence. How about vulnerability? Where do you see vulnerability? If I'm guilty of this, then have at it, kind of thing. Okay. What would you say would be the main emotion that drives the psalm? We may have differences of thought here, but what would you say would be the main one?
Eager expectation.
That's good. I probably think, Cassidy, you said confidence, right? I think that's where I would go. It's very similar to this. Now, just kind of a side story here. We're all family, so we can do this kind of thing, right? Tom and I had a little bit of interaction yesterday, because last week in Psalm 6, he kept emphasizing that the main emotion was sorrow. Remember that in Psalm 6? I said, no, it's anguish. And I kept thinking, where does he get sorrow from? So I got thinking about this. You know, it's a difference between he and I. I mean, we're quite different. So sorrow would, you know, that's how he would process Psalm 6. And I would see it more like frustrating and anguish and that kind of thing. So I talked to him about this yesterday, and I said, obviously, because you didn't have it right, because you thought sorrow and not anguish, there's something that speaks to deep emotional problems that you have that need to be worked on. So he was quite receptive to that counsel. So, all right, let's move on. It was a lot more funny at the time. All right, what truths about God are referred to? If you didn't know anything about Yahweh and you had no Bible, only Psalm 7, what could you piece together about him? Righteous, very good. Righteous and just. Yep, excellent. What else? If you didn't have anything else but only Psalm 7, you had to figure out who Yahweh is.
He searches minds and hearts.
Very good. So that would speak to his omniscience. Okay? Most High would speak to his
oppressors.
To his omnipotence. Okay? Tina?
You took that word.
Omnipotence? Okay. Yeah. All power? What else can we learn about God from this psalm?
Righteous judge.
Okay? Yep. Good. He honors, he treasures innocence, sinlessness, the upright in heart, something that he values. Others?
Shields and protects.
Very good. Yeah, I agree with you this time. That's very good, Tom. That's very good. Anyone else? What's that? He gets angry. Feels indignation every day. He takes sin seriously. He cares about it. It troubles him. Okay. Obviously, one who hears our prayers, this would speak to his benevolence. All right, and a big one, remember what I said about the wicked being spared? So God is also a God who is willing to forgive. There's grace, there's mercy here that we can find in this psalm about the Lord. All right, so when it comes to our own prayers, what would be the takeaway for us? How would this psalm serve as a model? How does it invite us to pray and worship? What sorts of things could we incorporate for ourselves? Because we work through the psalm and all that's very, very important, but we need to be able to connect it to us.
I think the vulnerability of David just speaks volumes. Really, you can share anything of your life with God because
all right. Excellent point from Psalm 7. There's more? Others?
David only asked God to have
Okay. I didn't hear real clear at the beginning. You're talking about more like a self-reflection?
Well, when he asked God to deal with the enemy first, he looked at himself.
Okay, got it. Yeah, good. Okay. Obviously, yep, good. Nate?
Even though it's a rhetorical device, he's still concerned as we should be with justice first and then his own feelings on the matter second. He's concerned justice as well.
Good point. Good? Okay. We've talked, Jesse? Yeah, perfect. Yep. Okay. We've talked about imprecatory statements in the Psalms quite a bit, and one phrase you always want to have burned in your mind when you come across these sorts of things is that it's better to pray for justice than do justice. And so we see this in this Psalm. He's quite agitated by the false accusations. He does not take matters in his own hand, but rather what he does is he is. If you remember the passage in Peter where it talks about Jesus did not return insult for insult and that sort of thing, but yet he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. And that's what we see in Psalm 7 is really that. David entrusted himself to one who judges justly, just like Jesus did. And so that is certainly a big takeaway for us in this. Anyone here ever been the object or the victim of malicious slander? False accusations. It just, you felt helpless in being able to do anything about it. People were believing the things that were being spread. Anyone? Okay, some. Right, no one else? Really? Okay. Well, I don't know what to say. I thought everyone would have raised their hands. But certainly, you know, as we talked earlier, it's sort of like those Apple applications. If you have this, there's an app for that. So if you're going through this, there's a psalm for that kind of thing. If you've ever been the victim, or if you are ever find yourself being the victim of malicious lies and false accusations and slander, then Psalm 7 would be a good fit for you in that, for sure. All right, well, actually, what I thought was going to be a short sermon has gotten a little long here. So let's just kind of wrap it up here with this. Next Sunday, we will be looking at, see if you can figure it out, what would be the next psalm for next Sunday?
Eight.
Psalm 8, very good. All right. Now, I'm not committed to doing all 150 psalms. I'm not even committed to doing all 41 psalms of book 1. That's really what our series is on. We will cover them to some extent. I think more or less what the plan here is to take them one at a time and get kind of a feel of how to work through them. And there may be Sundays we might look at two or three at a time and just kind of survey the basic message and not get too deep into exegeting every verse kind of thing. That's sort of the goal here. But next Sunday is Psalm 8. So we've had five laments in a row. But Psalm 8, we break from that. We're ready to kind of break and get into something a little bit more upbeat and pleasant. And Psalm 8 will certainly be that because we have a number of songs that we sing today and throughout the years that have been based on Psalm 8. So we'll look forward to that. So at this time, why don't we stand? We'll have the kids come in, and if the musicians could come forward.